Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with three, yes, three wonderful human beings. Anna Klosowska is a professor of French and an affiliate in women's gender and sexuality studies at Miami University in Ohio. Greta LaFleur is an associate professor of American studies at Yale. And Masha Raskolnikov is an associate professor of English at a little school called Cornell University. Welcome, welcome, welcome. It is so nice to talk to you. They've all joined to talk to me about their new edited volume, Transhistorical, Gender Plurality Before the Modern, out 2021 with Cornell University Friends, or Cornell University Press. And so we begin. How's everybody today?
Awesome, thank you.
Let's just hop right in, and I want to know how this book came about.
I think that Masha should tell the story, because we got together at the Conversions Conference that Kathleen Long, who is in the book, organized at Cornell, co-organized and invited so many interesting and wonderful people, including graduate students and people who are soon to become big stars. But we were lucky to all meet there. And I think if it was the movie version of our book, there would be a very, very important scene in a dive bar named Chanticleer.
I don't know if enough academic stories start with a dive bar, but they should. So what is this conference you were at?
It was called Transforming Bodies, actually, Anichka, and it was organized by Kathleen Long, who is sort of the grande dame at Cornell of queer and disability studies, really. And it was a lovely conference, and we had met up for coffee and then decided that we'd go out for a drink after the day's events had concluded. And there's a bar in Ithaca called the Chanticleer, which, of course, medievalists is a resonant name. It's the name of a horny rooster in Chaucer and in general sort of folk tradition. And so we went to this dive bar and we had just a lovely conversation. And one of the parts of that conversation that ended up growing into this book was us talking about how desperately there needed to be a collection that would bring together some of the exciting things that we saw happening in medieval trans studies and that we really wanted to encourage to have happen. So I feel like what we really said was somebody needs to do this. Somebody really needs to do this. We said that a few times and then we were like, huh, we could do this. And that was revelatory and fun. And what I remember is that at the time, because this was before the pandemic, our fantasy was actually that this would give us an excuse to meet up regularly in different places as we edited the book. And I believe we had a vision that we would write the introduction somewhere on a beach sipping tall drinks of some kind. Instead, we ended up writing the introduction from our respective homes and doing basically all of our meetings on Zoom or really phone sometimes. During the pandemic, often with my children in the next room coming in to interrupt whatever proceedings were happening. I kind of can't believe we pulled this off, that we really edited and wrote a book during the pandemic because it was an extraordinarily difficult time for all three of us.
And a time for our participants, right?
Yeah, and a really hard time for our participants. I mean, not to speak out of turn about anyone's health problems, but some people had long COVID while they at least did edits for their articles in the book.
And you know, all those really lost family members, and it was really a tragic time. And I think that, you know, I was going into it thinking, you know, I need this knot to do. And then it became like this motto behind everything I was doing because of the two of you. I really admire your work, and seeing you regularly was such a, oh my goodness, it was such a gift from the universe during that time.
You were some weeks you were the only adults that I would see, honestly. And I would only see you, quote unquote, on Zoom. So right. Yeah, it was an extraordinary isolating time, and working on this book was both really difficult and really helped save us.
And I wouldn't have done my portion if it wasn't for Masha asking me at each meeting, so how is your piece? And
I was really excited. I will speak to Anna's piece because I'm still talking about it. I was so excited about Anna's piece, which really does some of this work that we most wanted of recovering from the archive sort of gender nonconforming lives that would otherwise be lost or at least go without enough sufficient comment. And what I really loved about this paper, as it turned out, was not just that there was this archival record of a person who was roaming around Poland, charming everyone and marrying various people, both male and female, but also that Anna's argument ended up being, and I do tell people about your argument all the time because it makes me happy, which is a kind of a dorky thing to say about an academic work, but I think the best thing. Your argument made me really happy because Anna ended up arguing that, of course, we only have this one gender nonconforming person, but they're at the center of a network of other people who love and desire and let this person get away with things for a long time before they ended up in this courtroom, which probably ill effect. And so that meant there was like some kind of community of allies and lovers and friends of this person, and that this kind of queered medieval Poland, a time and a place that does not really usually occur to us first as the locus of the queer. So this piece gave me so much hope because, as you probably know, Poland currently has some wildly conservative politics around queer things. And it's, it's been my hope for the book that the book would be like, help us make the argument, be one piece of many pieces of making the argument that, like, wow, there really are gender nonconforming and trans effectively people in the historical past. We're not such people. Are not some kind of novelty that comes from the corrupt West, let us say. It is such people have always been and have always belonged and have always found support and love.
So this is a great point, right? This is one of the big questions. Like, first of all, were there trans and gender nonconforming people in history? Somehow is a question we're asking, which is an interesting, like, kind of, how was that even a question? But it is, right? It's a question that needs to be asked and answered. So like that, just demonstrating that a resounding yes is the answer is one of the things you clearly wanted to do with this book. What else were you hoping it would do? Because it feels like this is a book that with really high aspirations. And what else did you want to happen here?
I would turn it to Greta because Greta has this wonderful, we co-wrote the introduction, but I think Masha and Greta are mostly responsible for like the theoretical framing of it. And Greta wrote the post, the epilogue to the book. And the insistence on sort of listening and learning from history and sort of letting the present and history sort of talk to each other. And rediscover each other. I think that's the important part of the book. Another part is the many disciplines and many geographical locations as well as historical locations. So this book goes from Byzantium to Poland to the Americas, and from art history to literature to film in Korea. intentionally, and also in terms of professional status of the authors at the time of writing. So we sort of, we are at a point of our careers where it's our responsibility to help young scholars, and so we leverage that to really put, all our efforts into making sure that people have a career in trans and queer studies.
Yeah, if I could jump in for a sec. Sorry, I still have a little bit of my pneumonia on, so I'm coughing a bit. So hopefully I can keep it out. I think that one of the things that we were trying to do with the book was sort of toggle between like a kind of knee-jerk historicism, which kind of which is basically just a performance of it's a performance of historicism that is often sort of employed to mask a kind of conservatism in a number of different fields. And then toggle between that and then some sort of like uncritically celebratory, like trans people have always existed in exactly the way that we know them today. You know what I mean? And so one of the things that we were trying to do was think about, okay, well, what are some of the epistemological frameworks? What are some of the vocabularies for types of experience that people use to express, again, the embodied experience of living at odds with the sort of conventional gendered structures of their time and place? I'm so sorry. That's what we were kind of trying to do. And I think there are a lot of like functionally hegemonic ways that we think about transness today. For example, like, I don't know how many of you followed the like sort of like Twitter furor a few years ago about like people being trans enough. And like, you know, for example, are you not trans enough if you only live as trans for, or only identify as trans for 4 or 5 years of a 60 or 70 year life, right? And so one of the things that we were also kind of thinking about in the book is like people who lived as lived in a sort of gendered way that didn't sort of line up with the sort of social expectations for them. So yeah, it was just it's just about trying to think about ways of understanding gender nonconforming experience that don't line up and in some cases look like directly oppositional or contradictory or in tension with some of the ways that we think about trans experience today.
So you're talking about people who are living lives that don't match up with gendered, that are, you know, don't match the gendered expectations of their time. Okay. So that is one level of thing that we have to get into and explore, but that's only the beginning of the issue, right? With like then trying to sort out what's going on.
So I think that there's a lot going on in the book also on the different axes that intersect with the non-binary trans archives and literature. And one of them is disability studies, race. And I think there's a new conference coming up in May that a lot of the authors in the book are speaking or responding at that is very, very invested in working on that issue. So we just wanted to start conversation. I don't think, I think we wanted the conversation to be as capacious and as multi-form as possible. And as Greta says in her epilogue, open this to further discussion. That was very important for us to make a place, a safe place, a kind, congenial place, but a very, very smart place at the same time for people to start conversations from.
And I have been so happy, I must say, now that the book has been actually out for a little bit over a year, I've been so happy to find that people have been reading it, using it in their doctoral exams, in at least one case that I know of. I had a graduate application where the person wrote that they referred to the book as solace. I believe the word was solace when they felt negated by the world. And that made me, I actually forwarded that mess, that I cut that one sentence out of the application and sent it to my friends who co-edited the book, which was indiscreet, I suppose. But it was one sentence, no identifying information. And I was just so, that was really what we wanted, right? Or the joke that I've been making is that when you take the book in its final bound form, especially in hardcover. It's heavy enough to, you know, hit a turf with, but not that I'm advocating violence on the radio, but on the one hand, and on the other hand, it seemed like instead of violence that it offered a kind of kindness or soft place to land people. And I thought that was really great, but also, you know, intellectual challenge. I thought it was really interesting that we had some articles that were about sort of non-human or not necessarily like person-based forms of gender nonconformity. I'm thinking specifically now of like Emma Campbell's piece on the hyena and the gender of the hyena, which is a very interesting issue in medieval studies. And so that brings animal studies in dialogue with trans studies, which I thought was really cool to have, to put those pieces together. But also that critique of humanism is really important. We are not only talking about the human.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, the volume reflects like the sort of tendencies or trends in conversations in trans studies more broadly, you know? I mean, I think that one of the things that if you look at, for example, the Trans Studies Reader 2, which was, you know, a big kind of like watershed volume after the publication of the Trans Studies Reader 1, where Susan Stryker and Arne Zura sort of come together and they're like, you know, what's changed since, you know, I think it was 2006, and then Trans Studies Reader 2 is 2013, and those were still kind of two of the, like, earliest books. I mean, there were many others, but there's, I mean, but they were all kind of early in that, in their way. Excuse me. And you know, one of the things that they talk about in the introduction to the Trans Studies Reader 2 and what the volume in general kind of looks like is, like, taking frameworks, and in a lot of ways this reminds me of like early queer theory too, even as trans studies really has sought to distinguish itself from a lot of the sort of prerogatives and intellectual tendencies and epistemologies that involved inform queer studies, but like, you know, bringing like frameworks around, yeah, like the human, non-human, the post-human, the sort of relationship between humans, human animals, non-human animals, and machines, and thinking about, like, you know, lots of like larger scale biopolitical questions. I mean, all of this is, I think, in the ether and trans studies as a field, and so it was nice to see people bring it back to these earlier periods, in part because, you know, I think there's even a tendency in early trans studies or people working on these early questions to assume like, I think there's even a tendency among trans studies scholars who work on like the 19th and 20th century, the modern period, to think like, oh, well, like this is the period where it's at and like nothing happened before this moment. You know, and I think that our book was one of many efforts to try to interrupt that.
And I really worry about that tendency, actually. The more time I spend in this field, the more I worry about it, because to think that transness only begins in the 19th and 20th century is just completely to give over to the medical field and the medicalization, diagnosis, and treatment, so-called, of gender nonconforming lives, which just... Oh no, I just lost connection to server and then regained it. Am I here? Okay, I just got these messages. Yes. So rather than imagining that trans lives only began when the medical, when the world reached a certain level of medical knowledge, to think about trans lives earlier than that, I think is really important because it rejects that kind of paradigm of medical first. Or like, you know, medical transition first, surgery first, which is not really what is in our book.
Yeah, and that idea that this is a medical condition that needs to be fixed and can be understood, and it relies on binaries and like an absolute change and medicalization and all of these things. Yeah, it's really important. But I just want to make sure that I know you know this because you did it, but I want to make sure everybody realizes that it's hard. This is very intellectually challenging on just like every level. Finding the cases, figuring out how to read them, reading through multiple levels of language, right? And I mean metaphorical and actual language. And 16th century Polish isn't like modern Polish. This is a really massive undertaking. And I love the idea that you probably had a little bit to drink when you decided that you should do it. And but here we go.
That's right. So as languages wise, we have what? We have Greek, ancient, and Ottoman empires or Turkic, and we have Polish, which, by the way, you know, if you were Polish and were told there are only three genders, that's not actually true. There's seven for some parts of speech and 11 for others. So, you know, in the process of working on that piece, I discovered there are languages, there's a large group of languages who have up to 25 genders. And so we have Korean, we have Japanese, we have Spanish. I think that the, and French, of course. So I think that the, you know, this is part of what we're trying to accomplish, I think, right? To make sure that everybody has a way to enter it. And you were saying, oh no, now my postman has arrived. Come on, guys, down. So you're saying some of that work is difficult. And I was especially thinking of Masha Raskolnikov's piece on Silence, which is one of the most commonly taught medieval texts connected to trans studies, with this very typical in Indo-European story, in a patriarchal society where only men inherit, there is the child assigned at birth as female and raised as a man to inherit. And then at the very end of that story, there is this very, very suspicious reversal. So Masha was talking about the prequel to Silence, the parents, and the way that fiction sort of organizes thought and shows horizons that may not be very obvious in the historical record, sort of the weight of imagination. I've always, as a literary scholar, I've always been sort of attuned to the fact that most of our lives happen in our heads. So that part of the book, you know, is very interesting. But another issue that a lot of our authors have brought up is the ethics of doing that work historically. So here I would think there's a number of pieces that really think through that ethics, and I think that's very valuable.
Talk to me about the ethics of doing this work. What are the questions that you're bringing to the table? Greta?
Well, one of the ones that just came to mind immediately was just about the choice of language, like language that is now really understood to be offensive. And yet that was in the 18th century, for example, language that that people would sort of regularly use. Sometimes gender nonconforming people themselves would adopt to talk about their experience. And it makes sense, right? Like we reached for what is available vocabulary wise to sort of characterize and convey, you know, the meaning of our sort of everyday, you know, time on this earth. But it's more complicated to sort of bring those things to 21st century audiences. I think especially younger people who might have less familiarity with the sort of wide range of available linguistic terms, and then also with the fact that, like, with even the idea that it's itself, that language changes over time, and that the politics of it, the meanings of, you know, the same word doesn't mean the same thing in the same place, you know, in the same, you know, even in the same years sometimes. And we know this from just being people in the world, right? Like, if I say pop in, you know, Ohio, people will know what I think people say pop in Ohio, right? They definitely say it in Ontario. But if I say pop here, people will be like, what? Like, what are you asking for? Same thing when I ordered, I think one time I tried to order a seltzer in England, and people were like, Selta? Like, you know what I mean? Like, what is that? So that was one of the things that we were trying to think about. I think, I mean, you also end up with like basic archive ethics problems. Do you know what I mean? Like, so if you think about, you know, the farther back you go, the best preserved archives tend to be, you know, either the archives of people who are wealthy enough to maintain them, do you know what I mean? Or of people who are able to sort of cinch their hold on power for long amounts of time, who are frequently invested in the eradication of like various forms of gender plurality. And you know, and like thinking about, especially with the global sort of framework that we were trying to bring to the volume, I think we wanted it to be more global than it was, but we still have like a decent amount of representation from different regions. You know, I think about things like the transatlantic slave trade. I think about like the, you know, several hundred years of various global colonialisms that like made it so even vocabularies that were available to, for example, say like a 19th century British doctor, were being aimed at people who at times were not themselves actually like gender nonconforming identified or didn't really, wouldn't have necessarily described themselves that way, right? But because of, like, because of racial hierarchies, because of the way that gender is always understood through a sort of like racial schematic, people get painted with a sort of gender nonconforming brush by, again, 19th century British colonizers, when they may have had, when that may have actually had nothing to do with their experience, right? And we're only getting one side of that story. So those are just a handful of the kind of ethical issues.
There's also, and I'm thinking here of Scott Larson's really excellent article that concludes, except for Greta's epilogue, the volume. He has a beautiful essay called Laid Open, Examining Genders in Early America, that also grapples with the issues of the ethics, kind of the ethics of outing, which, you know, queer studies has also grappled with for quite a long time, but what it means to reveal or to think that one is revealing something about a person who is long dead and who's not here to speak for themselves. That, I think, is also really important. And I got to say, that's one of the reasons I work on fictions rather than on historical records, because it does feel very, the moment when Silence, the 13th century trans or not gender nonconforming knight, is, you know, stripped naked before the court, is a horrible traumatic moment. For me as a reader, and certainly for my students. And so, but that's fiction. There's not a real person suffering there. And you know, it is very complex to talk about people's bodies, especially people who can't speak for themselves. So that, I think Scott does a beautiful job grappling with that, stuff actually. And then I also think, and this is sort of an issue that seems like an ethics issue as well. I think also about assuming intentionality, and so that's rather than stripping people bare in their bodies and examining whatever their bodies hold as information, assuming or reaching for people's true intentions and what they were really trying to say, right? Which can be an act of bad faith, which can be, you know, really problematic, especially when we're sort of out there trying to find trans ancestors, or as the young people say, transcestors. We don't want to, we want to be ethical towards those long gone people as well, even though we need them so badly, right? We don't want to read into their lives too much. All that's being said, we have a whole book of examples of people being very ethical with their archives and finding all kinds of fabulous stuff. So it's not like this can't be done. It's that these are some of the complex obstacles that we grapple with.
Of finding, of understanding, and then as well of translating and telling the story, right? And that, I mean, there's always that tension back there too of figuring out what a person might have thought, how they were viewed, and what you can make of that anyway, and then how to translate that into a modern audience is its own problem, as, you know, just as historians,
But sometimes, like, the act of writing and the act of, being faced with readers helps produce this understanding. I think that was an important part of the book for many of the authors. And we enjoyed it too, right?
Okay. Yeah. I get this. I love this when I'm talking to you, is how much you clearly loved doing this book. And a lot of people don't.
Yeah. It was really a joy. I miss it now. We used to meet on Fridays. What was it? Friday mornings at 10, more or less every week for something like, I don't know, a year, maybe more. And, you know, sometimes it would be canceled and sometimes we would be, you know, in some kind of extreme state, but most of the time we met and it was the thing I looked forward to. And I got to say, spent my Thursdays preparing for every week. It brought a lovely scholarly structure into my life that I now miss, really. Even though it was damn hard work. And I got to say, all the essays went through two rounds of editing and you know, the authors were very gracious in response to critique, but we really worked with people. We were very hands-on, I'm afraid. And that was also part of the pleasure, was coming and working with such brilliant people and trying to make their work better and clearer still. Yeah, it was really fun.
I see that, because that's one of the benefits. It's one of the things that's really nice about this volume is it has, despite its incredibly broad scope and geographic and time and like subject matter methodology wise, it's a very broad, but there's a coherence that really separates this kind of that separates this from a lot of other edited volumes. It really works well together. I can tell you put the time in, you know. And one of the other things that sometimes is lacking, the most brilliant of scholars still work alone, and it's just not as good. You do better work when you get to talk to somebody about it and they read your work and talk you through it. And that, so the individual essays, I'm sure, benefited greatly from that as well.
I know I learned tremendously. Greta edited the hell out of my essay, and I learned so much from being edited by Greta personally.
Oh, your essay was in such good shape, though. I mean, I've done a lot of editing work, I think people need to be edited. I need to be edited. You need to be edited. Everyone needs to be edited. You know,
I want to credit you with basically what became. What I had written this article and I had presented it and I had chewed on it for a while before it got to the point where we were putting it into the book. But really, it was only when you read it, Greta, with your particular expertise and eyes, that I really understood that the underlying question that the article is really about sort of refusing a psychological narrative of transness, that it's really about imagining a gender nonconforming person, but subtracting the kind of coming out narrative aspects of it, the kind of suffering, desiring, choosing parts, which all get done for Celons, more or less. And since then, I've really been thinking, honestly, about this question of the will, which I also sort of deal with in other parts of my work, like the question of I think, interestingly, we also did this in early queer studies, right? The idea that coming out was a massive, significant act of choice, but that meant we were doing a kind of symptomatic reading of everyone as making choices. And the only alternative was a kind of biologicalist interpretation that would mean that, you know, we were all born this way. So trying to find a ground that was neither born this way nor here I am thinking and suffering and here is myself laid bare before you, that was really interesting. And I've really learned from Greta, who thinks about it this way. I really learned that as a way of reading certain kinds of fictions. So, you know, thank you so much for that.
I mean, my pleasure. I mean, everyone, we all edited each other, you know what I mean? I think we all learned. I mean, I learned a lot from editing everyone's essays. I mean, I think we all read all the essays, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, we all read all the essays, but we also assigned, I can't remember the numbers anymore, like 4 of them each, where we would work individually with the authors for a time and then we would switch. So we had a system. There was a system. There were numbers involved. I can't remember numbers.
So you, Masha, you talk about Celons, right? And you choose fiction, you mentioned, because it's less traumatic, but there's also something. What does fiction give us? I'm not going to try to answer your question. The question I'm asking you. Why fiction? What does that give us?
Well, fiction captures what people imagine or dream of. It allows a kind of mental experiment with what the world can be. What I fundamentally, although I don't think I put this anywhere in writing, believe about Celons is that the way it's written is it's written that way because if you're going to make a gender nonconforming character and have them be a hero in a text in the 13th century in France, you kind of have to make it something that they get forced into, you know, twist my arm, make me trans kind of thing. You have to do that because that is how you get away with creating a character so radical, right? So everything that happens in that fiction, I think, is done, possibly, this is very much like my sense of the thing, is done because making it offensive and weird in the ways that it's offensive and weird, permits it to exist. Right. And it only exists in a single copy. It's not something that is, but it survives to our day. We get to find it and touch it. And it has, you know, illustrations that Anna has seen and I have not. It's this extraordinary work, and it survives partly because I think it makes certain kinds of narrative choices. But you can't really do that in life. You can't actually tailor your life in a way that makes it palatable to others. And so you can see the workings of choice, dream, imagination, experimentation in fiction, where with life, you mostly encounter most of the folks that we encounter were gender nonconforming. We were encountering in court records where they were being, you know, punished for some aspect of their lives, often for their gender.
Yeah. Right. And catching only the transgressive moments as opposed to any of the countless moments in between.
Yes. Yes, yeah. It's always a crisis when we get people in the law records.
Like, Anna, like your case, yeah, that where we find someone who has lived a very long and joyful life, and or interesting at least, and with moments of joy, and then we find them at this moment when things are kind of crashing down, right?
Right. And so, you know, again, going back to this question of ethics, right, we have to be very careful about sort of reading between the lines, and also not foreclosing the argument. Greta always insists on that there's always something more to be seen, and I'm sure Masha, working with literature, does that too, that there's always another reading. For some reason, that case has never been translated into English, so this is a great thing to have it, and it speaks so well to this other case from 1384 London that Gabi Buchowski writes about in the volume, and that everybody pretty much knows, Eleanor. And but I think that what we find when we look at the archives, especially later archives of people who are non-binary or trans, is that there are these huge archives. They tend to amass documentation. They tend to have this archival desire to make their experience historically legitimate, right? There's always a precedent for them. They're also oftentimes writing for children, which is also very interesting, I find. There's something really important about being able to open this book, which is, by the way, super cheap, right? We worked very hard to make it incredibly affordable, and say, look, there's this heavy volume of all of these cases, crossing all sorts of disciplinary and geographic boundaries. And it reminds me of something I'm working on right now, which is Montaigne, and reading Montaigne's Journal de Voyage. And he goes from one village in which there was a number of people who were assigned as female and then lived as men. And then next village, you know, it's the birthplace of Joan of Arc. And so is there really, you know, a non-binary person in every village in France? Or is it like Montaigne's queer tour of France?
That's so delightful, Anna. I want to see that article.
Yeah. I also want to go on Montaigne's queer trip through France.
I love that, and I want to read that. Can I also say that I am now engaged in a new editorial project also that I think very much follows up from this one, because I was so excited to work on this project that now I want to collaborate with people all the time. And so me and Bridget Wearty, who is a digital medieval studies person, and we are working together on something that is right now called Always Here, a Queer and Trans Global Medieval Sourcebook. And we're hoping to make that even more global, even with an even greater geographical reach for all the problems that's going to involve than transhistorical. And we want to just basically put the stuff that we use for teaching together with all the other stuff that everyone else has been hoarding that they use for teaching, that we could put together to make a really solid internet and probably paper archive of what the trans Middle Ages look like. We are saying that we're going to stop with the Middle Ages, that we're not going to go into the early modern, because the explosion of texts we get in the early modern, we're just going to leave that to other experts to get. But it's so wonderful because, you know, in a very basic way. I'm always standing over the hot copier PDFing primary texts that don't exist in print and that you cannot find online and that are not, you know, that basically you have to make a copy in order to have a copy of hundreds of pages in my life have been, I have done in this way. You know, that feeling of dryness you get when you're standing over a photocopier. I haven't found a better way to do it. And you know, putting that stuff together so that it's available for everybody and so that we can share it, both for teaching and for joy, seems like a really fun thing to do. So I'm afraid that might take me the rest of my life. I'm a little worried about what a massive undertaking this could potentially be. I wanted to say that's what we're doing.
That's wonderful. Exciting. Yeah. Wow. So we're closing in kind of on the end of our talk here, and I had a whole bunch of questions that I'm just not going to do, and that's fine because this was great and I'm perfectly happy. But one more thing I want to talk about. The hyena article. God, that was cool. But so I was talking to one. Yeah, no, really good and kind of an interesting way to think about methodologies. And how you use, like, which is, so the book's in these three sections, Interventions, Critical Transmythologies is the third, and it involves, that's where the hyenas come in. The second, Frames Work, Representing Early Trans Lives, as Masha's piece, and the first section, Archives, Revisiting Law and Medicine, which has Anna's essay. And those are good demo. We've talked about those a little, so you can get a feel for what the book has for you. But so today I'm talking to one of my students about this, And I talked about Anna's person, and the student says, like, so, but wait, so were there trans people? Like, oh, kiddo, what am I gonna do with you right now? And I thought maybe that would be a nice, you know, I just tossed that to you. Were there trans people? How do you answer that question? What do you mean? Like, of course, or what? I don't know. I have no idea what to do with that. I started talking for a very long time. That's what I did because I'm a professor. But
I would give that a resounding yes. Partly, I would give that a resounding yes because I think I can speak for all three of us when I say I don't think that any of us believe that in order to be trans, one needs some specific intervention or some specific action to be taken. And so because we are not proponents of you're not trans enough, I think that, you know, it's not that these medieval people, you know, couldn't get gender reassignment surgery and therefore they don't count. They were doing what they were doing. So I will speak to, like, Eleanor Rickner, who is in Gabby Bukowski's beautiful essay, which actually I think does a lot methodologically for trans studies, imagines how beautiful Eleanor Rickner must be when she gets hired by a John in Cheapside. And then they get caught for, you know, selling sex and buying sex and have to testify. And Eleanor is dead named throughout the testimony, but we know that she goes by Eleanor. And we have an entire narrative of how she was taught how to pass as a woman by other women sex workers, and that there's some kind of community around her that had nurtured and taught her to do this, which, how is this not trans? Right? How is this not part of a lineage that, it works its way up to the present day? I would be slightly indignant to be asked this question, honestly. Kind of indignant if it was my student, but kind of indignant.
I think there was a lot there too about language and was there, you know, but the gender's destabilized. So Greta, what would you say?
Yeah, I was gonna say actually, like, I think I would say something on the no spectrum. Do you know what I mean? But then follow up with a couple questions and say, look, it's not that there weren't gender nonconforming people. There's always been gender nonconforming people, but, like, I think that like what might we get out of saying no, there weren't trans people, but there were people who understood themselves at all as being as living and experiencing themselves in the world as at odds with these gendered systems around them, these conventional gendered systems around them. And what words do you think they used? How did they think about it? Like, for me, I feel like that question is more of an opportunity. You know what I mean? is more of an opportunity, because it's not, I guess I'm not really teaching any classes where like students are like, were trans people, like, do trans people exist or not, which is just, you know, my luck. Like I teach, for example, trans studies every year. But like, yeah, I guess for me, I think there's a way that I really get nervous about a kind of like epistemological or even ontological like homogeneity, in terms of like that, like people are really, really I think that homogeneity is why there was like a controversy of like, is so-and-so trans enough? Do you know what I mean? And I, like, there's a part of me that just wants to push back against this in all ways. And because I also think that not letting things go unsaid, and not letting like a particular version of trans or a particular version of gender nonconformingness be the sort of unspoken normative whatever version is like always like intellectually helpful. Do you know what I mean? Because I like, you know, and I even talk about this with my students sometimes in terms of what I call microgenerational differences. Although honestly, the older I get, I feel like now we're just actually at a generational difference. But like, you know, I'm like I'll say to them like, look, the way that I grew up thinking about what transness meant and what that looked like, what it could be, is like often in many cases really different from the way that you guys are experiencing it yourselves. And I like really respect the way that you guys are thinking about it, but you're gonna run into ways that like your version of it is in tension with the way that I kind of experience it. And that's fine. And what, don't we want more of that, you know? So that's kind of my kind of concern.
Well, I mean, and you finished the essay with against consensus, which really makes an argument for a lot of space, for a lot of, it's a really, really beautiful just contemplation of the lack of consensus, of continuing to ask questions and really not accepting answers. I really enjoy your essay.
Yeah, and I think having all these anecdotes, which are just so rich with detail, is just so wonderful and illuminating. And it illuminates both sides. I think that I really like what Greta said about each generation of high school graduates has their own way to do gender differently, right? And yet there is this very profound feeling of home when you read the historical narratives, and then, you know, you learn from them. You learn things that you maybe not noticed today. So
brilliant, wonderful. Hey, so I know what Masha's doing next. I know what Anna's doing next. Greta, what are you doing next?
So I'm trying to finish the second book project I'm working on, which is more of a history of sexuality project, although it does have a chapter on TERFs at the end, on TERF politics at the end, which is something I've been working on a little bit. Like, me and my friend Serena just did a special issue of TSQ on trans exclusionary feminisms and the global right.
Excellent issue.
Yeah, honestly, I feel really happy with that issue. But then I also am doing another editing project, because I keep saying that I'm not going to, and then I keep signing up for them. Which is, I'm a series editor with Blake Gutt and Emily Skidmore for a Bloomsbury cultural history of trans lives. So it's like a 6-volume thing. So I'm not like, I know exactly, it's a big project, but I'm not one of the specific volume editors. I'm just the series editor with those two guys. So yeah, I think that'll be, and that's under contract, but we're not going to be submitting the whole thing for like 2 more years at least, I think.
Oh, all right. That's great. Lots going on and lots of really cool new things to work on. I'm so excited about that. It has been a while since I've read something that I don't know. So many times I found myself just kind of staring into the distance and having no answers. And it was really, how fun is that, right? To just read something and leave with more questions than answers in a very good way. It was really great.
That's why I went into medieval studies in the first place, is because it kept doing that to me.
Well, perfect. That makes sense.
Yeah. But having the three different, you know, brains was such a joy too, you know. For instance, the image on the cover, Greta knows the artist, and just the way that other people have also chipped in, you know, having conversations about the title, and all of that is footnoted in the book. So,
yeah, and the book, once again, listeners, the book is Transhistorical, Gender Plurality Before the Modern. It came out late in 2021 with Cornell University Press. It is out and it is, yeah? Am I not right? Yes. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, okay. And it is widely available. And as Anna noted, at a very good price. So buy this one, bring it home, share it with your friends and loved ones, and all of your students, even if they will say, but then I don't understand gender nonconformity. Like, but I don't either. Like, let's see. I don't either. Tell me about it. I don't know either. It's pretty great. All right. Thank you so much for joining me. This has been an absolute delight. And I am looking forward to the next time we get to do this.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Yay. So
thank you for having us.
It was wonderful. Bye.